Join Austin Film Festival on Monday, March 30th at the Texas Spirit Theater in Austin for a four-day retrospective, Growing Up Bombeck. To celebrate the upcoming release of his latest feature, While We're Young, AFF will be hosting a four-day marathon of Noah Baumbach's best works, including Kicking and Screaming, The Squid and the Whale, and Francis Ha, as well as an exclusive pre-release screening of his new film. For more on this and all other Austin Film Festival events, go to austinfilmfestival.com. Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast is now available on the Stitcher app. Search Austin Film Festival to listen. If you're in Austin, catch a full hour of On Story on KUT 90.5 at 9 p.m. every third Monday of each month in 2015. Today, on Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast, filmmaker Jay Duplass.
All it really is about is expressing the things that are inside of you and sharing them with other people. That's really all that matters.
Writer-director Jay Duplass has collaborated with his brother, Mark Duplass, throughout his career. The two rose to prominence with their DIY shorts, This Is John and Scrapple, which garnered high praise at Sundance. The Duplass brothers followed up with a string of features in the mumblecore movement, including The Puffy Chair, Cyrus, and Baghead. Jay Duplass is now acting in the Amazon Studios comedy drama Transparent, and with his brother Mark, shares the helm of the HBO series Togetherness, which has been renewed for a second season. This conversation was recorded at the 21st Austin Film Festival in 2014 and was moderated by Austin American Statesman reporter Matthew Odom. We begin with Jay Duplass describing the early days, This Is John, Sundance, and The Puffy Chair.
Well, you know, I came here in 1991, and it was a magical time in film in Austin. Linklater's Slacker was in the Dolby at midnight, and everyone was talking about film. And I was like, what do you mean? You mean cable? You mean that thing on the front lawn? That's what you're talking about, right? You know? And I started to wake up a little bit to the fact that film is an art, and specifically that movies didn't just get pumped in over a cable like human beings made movies. Very specifically, Rick Linklater, who had the same haircut as me, that terrible haircut we had in 1991, you know, the little bowly kind of long in the back. And, you know, I would see him around. I would just see, he was in the union, student union at UT, eating crackers and ketchup because he was broke. Little did I know that would be the next 13 years of my life and what it looked like in Austin. It just woke me up a little bit like, oh, that dude made that movie. And someone in Hollywood doesn't have to take a sword and like knight you shoulder to shoulder. And I started taking more classes, and then I ended up almost getting another major in RTF, and just I started writing, and we were making movies on 16 millimeter and cutting them with razor blades, super old school. In true form, they were terrible. Prior to Linklater here, like I saw Raising Arizona when it came out, I was probably about 16 years old. And that truly was the first time that I was like, oh, people made this movie. And I have never seen them, but I kind of know what they're like. Like, I kind of feel connected to these two brothers. But, you know, in a weird way, we've always been not that observant or brainy about how we do what we do. I mean, honestly, Mark would like come visit me from high school, and I was in at UT, and I would make a movie and I'd put him in it, and we just kept doing it, and they were bad, and every once in a while one of them wouldn't be so bad, and we'd be like, what wasn't so bad about that movie? And you know, it really was more of just like a feeling around in the dark process, cavemanish kind of process. But I think all those influences are, they're always in you, and you're trying, you know, we were always trying to make something that was like deep and funny at the same time. It's very easy to think that we can all make movies, you know, but the truth is like, it's an incredibly complex form where you're synthesizing good story that is well told and is told in a visual way. And the people that you're telling the story to are like 2 years away. You know, if you're a painter, no one really expects to like sell a painting for a decent amount of money until they've made like hundreds of paintings. But everyone has this weird subconscious thing in their mind that they're going to wake up one morning and just write something and then make it, and it's going to be the best thing ever. And I really feel like that just doesn't happen. It doesn't happen for anybody. It didn't happen for us, and it didn't happen for Linklater, and it didn't happen for Soderbergh. Maybe Soderbergh. No, he made movies earlier, but I think Sex, Lies, and Videotape is definitely, I think, in his strongest works. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed that too. Like, filmmakers who do come out and kind of like make something great right off the bat, they generally don't just keep making great, great things. Like, you know, there has to be some learning curve. So all this is just to say that I think it's an incredibly difficult thing to make something that doesn't suck. And it took me 10 years of making things consistently. I mean, I wasn't writing and directing things always. I was editing here in town a lot and, you know, learning what not to do mostly, because there's a lot of bad stuff out there. It's really hard to make something great. Basically, we just had a huge, huge, huge breakthrough. And I was 29 years old, and I was losing my fucking mind because I was living in Austin and making $14,000 a year. And, you know, I was just eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and just I hadn't made anything great. And I looked back on my editing stuff, too, and I was like, but I didn't really edit. I'd edited, like, two things that I was proud of. And I was just pushing 30 and getting to that point where it's like, how much longer can I do this to myself and to my family? And, you know, my brother said, okay, we're going to make a movie today. And I said, well, how are we going to do that? We don't have a 16 millimeter camera. I don't have crew. I don't have lights. And he said, I don't care. We have mom and dad's video camera, the little one chip mini DV. And he said, come up with something. And so my idea was, it's like I had to just come from my own life, because I didn't have like all this time to think up like something that was going to blow the world's mind. You know what I mean? I was like, well, okay, this thing happened to me yesterday where I tried to like re-record the greeting of my answering machine. Yes, it was an answering machine at the time. Press the button, beep. And I kept repeating it, and I couldn't get it right, and I kept fucking it up, and I had a nervous breakdown. fucking hilarious, right? And, you know, his eyes just widened so big when I told him that story, which is now the basis of how we create stories. We tell each other stories, and when you don't have to ask if he likes it or not, you see it. And he was just like, that's everything. And I had a one button down shirt and some pants with pleats that I had used when I worked for the Kelly people. And and he went and got it, and he looked at the back of the shirt, and it was called a John Ashford shirt, and that became his character name. And he walked in the door, and I filmed a 20 minute one take of him doing this. And he was in a similar place to me, and he tried to get it right and got it wrong and had a breakdown and cried. And I talked to him during the take and just kind of guided him. And we cut it down to 7 minutes. And just for the fuck of it, we submitted it to Sundance. And the head of the festival called me a month later and said, this is my favorite short that I've seen in a very, very, very long time. And I said, fuck you, David Zellner. Why are you messing with me? And it wasn't David or Nathan. It really was Trevor Groth from Sundance Film Festival. And that 20-minute period, and the movie cost $3. We went to Circle K and bought a mini DV tape. And that's what it cost, for real. And there was nothing. It was just me and Mark and a camera. And it changed everything. I mean, our whole lives, we were like, okay, let's tell a story about, like, man's struggle against the world and stuff like that. And you just make a movie, and it's just a piece of shit, and no one likes it. And then you make a movie about you crying in front of an answering machine, and Variety writes, this is an epic struggle about man versus technology. That's a true story. I think the biggest thing I've learned from that is that, you know, we all think in our heads so much. I still do it about what I'm going to do to the world and all this stuff and how I'm going to make this great thing happen and oh shit, all this, I got to channel the universe here. And what this is all about is that is the day that I figured out what I uniquely had to offer the world, which is the pathetic, desperate, fucking hilarious shit that I put myself through every day. I don't think that you can decide that. I think that has to happen to you, and I think the persistence is a big part of it, because you make things and you put it in the world, and then the world will tell you if it's great or not. But they were mystified. Like, we were in Sundance watching people, and like one guy was like laughing his ass off, and his wife was like crying, and she was mad at her husband because he was laughing too much. And we were like, fuck, man, this is really something. I think we're on to something that we don't really understand. So, you know, the next movie we made was a tiny bit bigger. It cost $50, and it was involved Mark and his girlfriend in a kitchen that moved to a living room. We added one room, and they were playing Scrabble. And we were noticing all the, just the depth of shit that was coming up during Scrabble. This motherfucker thinks I'm stupid. He thinks I'm stupid, and I'm gonna show his ass. You know, I mean, just that's the inner dialogue of playing Scrabble with your loved ones. And they ended up having a huge fight. And that was the second short film that we got into Sundance. We had made two short films that went to Sundance, and we were terrified of making a feature because we had made a couple of really cheap features here in Austin in our mid-20s that didn't work out. And we were just terrified to fuck it up again. But we knew that we were really good short filmmakers, not because we thought it, but because the whole world was telling us that we were. You know, we were like winning awards at like South by Southwest and Sundance and Berlin, and you know, it was a big thing. And the reason we made Puffy Chair is because the Sundance programmers called us and said, guys, please stop making short films, will you just make a feature? And it's like, wow, okay, maybe that's the time to make a feature, is when someone tells you. We were like, okay, terrified of feature filmmaking, but we're good at shorts. Why don't we do this? Why don't we make a feature film that's basically like 13 5-minute shorts in a row? And we were like, that, yeah, that's like a road movie, basically, where it just goes in a line, and the road is the spine, and you just hang these short films on it. And so that's what we did. And we used all the materials that we had available to us at the time. We had just moved to Brooklyn for dumb reasons, basically because all the filmmakers at Sundance were in Brooklyn. We're like, we have to move to Brooklyn. I don't know. So we just moved to Brooklyn. We had a Brooklyn apartment. Mark's girlfriend, Katie, was from a small town in Maine that was not only going to allow us to shoot there, but would like beg us to shoot there and like, can we come out and be extras in your movie for free? And we're like, yeah, that's great. And Mark had a van for touring with his band at the time, and those were the materials that we needed to make that movie, that and a DVX 100. I don't know why that movie took off the way that it did. I feel super lucky about it. It was definitely a darling at Sundance. I think the fact that it cost $15,000 for real, not made up stuff. You know, it was a handmade movie. The only crew was me and John Bryant, who's also an Austin filmmaker. We were basically a documentary crew. But I don't know. It just, the audiences were like devouring it at Sundance. And I think I know now there's not a lot of people who do smart comedy well. I mean, there's like crazy balls out comedy like Dumb and Dumber 2, which I'm going to brag right now. I'm going to the premiere and I'm fucking psyched. And then there's drama. But there's a pocket of really smart comedies that, I don't know, there's not a lot of them out there, you know? And I think people want that. And studio heads really want that. So that they were very interested. And in their mind, they were irrationally thinking, if these guys, look what they can do with $15,000. What if we gave them $15 million? The movie would literally be like 1,000 times better. I mean, that's what was going. I don't know what the math works out. You can check it later.
Impressive, yeah.
Yeah, we started, you know, writing scripts for different people, and we started developing Cyrus with Fox Searchlight pretty much right after Puffy Chair.
Working with actors, the Duplass brothers process, sharing the wealth, and arriving at acting.
I mean, we still never rehearse. We try to audition all of our actors. And by audition, I mean like run 30-minute takes and get weird as shit so that we are understanding the depth of this human being who's here and what it is that they want to bring, as opposed to a bunch of intellectual ideas about what it could be. Because we've just learned that in our realm, like, especially in the realm where all that really counts in our movies are the interactions between human beings and how true they are, we just want to see the thing as it unfolds. So we have been surprisingly successful in getting famous people to come in a room and bear everything in an audition realm, which is rare. Doesn't always happen, but, and then we don't really rehearse on set because I would say 30% of what is in our movies is a first take that is such a big surprise that no one could have predicted it. And everyone in the room is like, it's alive, you know? I mean, they've told us in general that, like, even just watching our movies, they're like, I don't know what you're doing, but I know that real things are happening on your sets, and I know that they're happening over a long period of time. Like, we're not doing setups where it's like, okay, move to the yellow mark, turn to the left, say hello, cut. You know, it's, we run the whole scene, and things happen, and things are open, and anything could really happen in that moment. And I think not all actors like that. A lot of actors hate it, and they stay away from us, but the ones who are craving that, and I would say most actors are craving that, have told us so much as, like, I will sleep on your sofa if we can do something like that, you know? I mean, I try to, like, disobligate all my actors when they come on set. The main thing I tell them is it's not your job to do anything. It's your job to, like, be real and react naturally, and it's my job to make sure that a story comes out of this. All their job is just to, like, be that character and be true in that moment. You know, we're very careful with each other emotionally, and, you know, we do have a marriage, and that is hard. You know, it's hard. I'm married, and I have kids, and I also have a marriage with my brother, so it's, like, it's a lot to manage, but it's, you know, it's worth it. And, you know, one of us has an idea. We tell the story orally to each other. One of us will write the first draft. Usually the other one will write the second draft. We trade back and forth. When we're on set, it used to be that I was operating the camera, so I'd just be in the room operating and talking to the actors, and Mark would be on monitors kind of watching. I'm operating a little bit less. He acts in our HBO show that we're making right now, so I'm a little more talky on the directing side. But, you know, we don't have this, like, dictatorial vision of how things have to happen. It's like we run a take, Mark and I talk about what just happened and whether we think that's the right direction or not and what's interesting about it, and we start shaping it. And by, like, take three or four, it's usually just looks across the room like, yeah, go do that again. Okay. You know, and people just, like, hold while we do our weird brother talk. And then we, you know, do another take. But it's just very homemade. It's very, our golden rule of filmmaking is simply, what do you want to see next? It's all about trying to get the intellectual out of the way. Again, not visionary whatsoever, not planned, not decided. It kind of started that when we were prepping Cyrus, Brian Poyser called us when he was making Lovers of Hate, and he said, guys, I have one day to get $5,000 or this movie is not going to happen. And we were, like, getting paid to make Cyrus. And, you know, I was like, I can give up $2,500. And Mark said, I can give up $2,500. That was literally the beginning of it. It was just like, let's just help Brian not die. Because Brian doesn't make this movie, he's going to die. And so that started that. And then, you know, we helped him with Sundance and, you know, looked at cuts and stuff. So it was just very organic sort of, like, process. And then that movie made a little bit of money and it returned our investment. And then it just sort of turned into, I don't know, especially in Austin at the time, I mean, there were just so many people that we knew that were super talented that it really just started with us helping our friends, you know? And then there was another sort of level to us producing things, which is Mark being a frustrated actor and just hating auditioning and not wanting to do that. He started to realize that if he produced stuff that he could act in, it would be good, mm-hmm. You know, so he made Hump Day with Lynn Shelton. And so it just kind of started there. And then the next sort of level was, you know, while we were waiting to make Cyrus with Fox Searchlight, we made two other feature films, Baghead and Dodecapentathlon. Baghead here and Dodecapentathlon in New Orleans, where we grew up. And we were just basically continuing to make movies because we didn't want to let other people decide whether we could make movies or not. And so we were making them super cheap and using our writing money to pay for them. Dodeca was produced by our high school friend, Stephanie Langhoff. She'd returned to New Orleans from working in New York on big movies for a long time and didn't know what she was doing. And we were like, can you produce our movie? And so since then, she's sort of run our company, and she has been spearheading some of the more intense, bigger things that we've produced, like, you know, Skeleton Twins and Safety Net Guaranteed. I never thought I would act. I was always operating the camera, so it was like literally not even a physical reality that I could, you know, get out there. Never really occurred to me. I did take Ron Hayden's class out here for 6 months. I don't know if you knew. There was like a acting cult workshop going on in East Austin for about 10 years there. I was in a cult for 6 months, a very good cult that a lot of great actors, Rhett Wilkins, who is in The Puffy Chair, was in it with me. Jet Garner, who's in Baghead, was in it with me. There was some naturalness to being in it. I just mostly wanted to be comfortable with actors and comfortable in, like, you know, I think there's a lot of discomfort with directors and actors. Like, actors are terrified of directors and directors are terrified of actors. And very specifically, like, being in a realm, in an acting realm, where anything can happen can cause a lot of anxiety. And I wanted to be in a space where it didn't, where it was like free and exciting, and that helped me get there. But I mean, I think people have always told me I should act, and I was just like, sure, whatever, how? I don't know. You know, I'm pressing the button behind the camera over here. So, but I guess in the last few years, my friends in LA have started to put me in things, and it's been great.
Transparent, togetherness, and an influential and inspiring Austin filmmaker.
I met Jill Soloway at a director's party. We have these director's parties in LA where we go and we talk about actors and who's crazy and who's not crazy. Yes, actors, it happens. And she just made Afternoon Delight, and I was a big fan of it. And she was trying to cast the role of this guy on this TV show that I'm in right now called Transparent. And the role was of the brother, 35-year-old, sort of neurotic, smart, charismatic, insecure mess of a Jewish guy. And I was like, I know all those guys in town. I was like going through a list of all my friends who I thought were great actors that would fill the role. And she had thought of all of them. She's like, no. And we kept talking. And then she's like, it's you. And I was like, Jill, I'm not really Jewish. I have an HBO show. I'm super busy. I'm not really an actor. And she's like, come in tomorrow. And I went and I did a reading with her, and it was amazing and fluid. And she not only let me do all these things that I just impulsively wanted to do, but was like applauding it and, you know, celebrating it.
Do you get the sense that you're going to learn anything from working with Jeffrey Tambor?
Oh God. Yeah. I mean, I already have. I mean, he's a master. It's interesting because I think most people, and especially young people, only know him from Arrested Development and imagine him in an orange jumpsuit and a black skull cap. But, you know, he's like a heavy-hitting, you know, theater actor from New York in the 70s, you know. I've learned a ton from him, and I've learned a ton from Jill about not the TV world, but just Jill was one of the original writers on 6 Feet Under, which I think is really like the beginning of that, and Sopranos are really the beginning of like this whole world of TV, which Jill and I sort of call like long form storytelling. It's like a feature that just keeps on going and going. And so I've just learned a lot about that from her. Togetherness came about in a really stupid way. My brother is on this TV show called The League, and he goes away for 3 or 4 months every fall. And I was like, I want to do something in the fall. So like wrote this like pilot that I was going to shoot with my friend Steve Zissis, who's in Baghead. He's my best friend, that I was just going to have fun, maybe act in it, maybe just make a web series or something. Once it was written, all of our friends were like, no, this is not a web series. Do yourself a favor, pitch this to HBO. And we pitched it, and they loved it. And it was the type of story that just could go on forever and ever. It's about being 40 and having kids and trying to make your dreams come true, and how both of those things is almost impossible. And how it's like you're this close to drowning in every second. More of the answering machine, basically. And I've been thinking about this a lot. I would say the main thing that's different about this kind of TV in particular, which is serial, long-form storytelling, is that you are living in an open universe. HBO's been amazing at kind of helping me go through that. It's weird because when I pitched it to HBO, they said yes, but they didn't want it to be about one character and three peripheral characters. They wanted it to be about four characters that were equal. And I couldn't get my head around it because I'm a feature filmmaker, and there's so many things about feature filmmaking that It is natural to the form, so this is not a negative comment, but there's a lot of artifice that goes into feature film writing. In particular, shit like when you're writing your first 20 pages, everything that all the little nuggets you're setting up, you're literally already thinking about how you're going to pay those off in like 100 minutes. You know when you're in a movie and you're like, yeah, I can see where this is going. They got to get together and, you know, the things have to happen, so all the things have to go. TV doesn't have that. And that is incredibly powerful. And I don't think it's just TVs in everybody's houses and home theaters that is making this kind of HBO storytelling so powerful. It has something to do with the fact that it is an open universe. And I think what I've been learning is that you have to do your plotty payoffs in every episode, but the big, big emotional shit that's going on with your characters just keeps expanding and growing. And there's something incredibly natural about it that is so freeing that I'm so excited about it, I can't even deal with it right now. Because that's one of the biggest things that Mark and I have had trouble with in our features, is like finding that perfect sweet spot of how to give people that closure that they need, but to keep it real. Like with Puffy Chair, we didn't really give people the... Everyone wanted that couple to get together, even though they're fighting their asses off the whole goddamn movie. And when we showed it at Sundance, the premiere, we didn't think it was that big a deal because, you know, we were going through that at the time, being in your mid-20s and trying to figure out if you're going to get married or break up, and either option seems totally viable. you're out of your fucking mind, you know? And the movie ended, and they broke up, and the movie went to black... And a dude in the back of the audience went, no! In an angry way. Like, a way that made me just want to be like, I'll just slip out the back. So there's, TV is different form. Mark and I write all the scripts. We have a tiny writer's room that meets like once every week or two that is Steve, our main guy, and my friend, and our editor, and this one writer woman that we know and love. The writer's room is more of just like our friends on retention. You know when you give your script to friends and it takes them fucking 6 weeks to read that shit? These people are paid to read that crap and get back to you within 12 hours. It's great. It's so great. And, you know, the writer's room is in my house. It's in my back. I have an office behind my garage, old, you know, Austin style. And so, I mean, Mark and I, in the first season, we attempted to have someone write one episode. We did eight, and we had one write one, because I was asking Judd Apatow, I was like, how do you do this and not die? That's the big question. He's like, you got to get help. So we tried, and we tried. We had one person also direct one episode. And the people who wrote and directed these are phenomenal human beings, but it just didn't work for me and Mark. It was harder for us to oversee the writing and directing than it was to actually do it ourselves. And, you know, we just, although we are the showrunners of the show, we learned that we are not, when it comes to our material, we're just cavemen. We just have to make it, you know, the way that we make it. For other people's material, it's okay for us to just produce it, but not for our own stuff. And I think part of it, too, is that our stuff is not high concept. Our stuff is extremely low concept, actually. It's just the way that we do it that makes it special. I would just say that the biggest influence that Rick has had on me is he does whatever the fuck he wants to do. He is doing so many different kinds of things. And he set the tone for Austin, you know? I mean, he, in a weird way, validated the caveman way that Mark and I have always made art and now movies and music when we were making music and all that stuff is just like, I mean, in a way, like, Rick doesn't try to carve up his movies in palatable ways. He doesn't look at other styles and try to emulate them so that it like feels like something else. Like, and every movie he makes is completely different. And so that's just super inspiring. And just the whole feeling of just being yourself. And that really has to do with all of Austin, which is always like in my mind, my home, you know, because I used to joke about people like, before I made movies that actually went on screens, like I made art and my distribution platform was my front lawn on Mary Street. You know, I mean, that's like that's the MO of Austin is, and I think that's the most important thing is like the things that are inside of you need to come out in some way. And Austin has ways to do that. I mean, even before we had this other little film called The New Brad, which is a weird little movie that we made. And there was something weird going on. This is, you know, right before we went to Brooklyn, where all these people were like doing these backyard screenings and people were like replicating this tape of this dumb little movie we made. And they kept showing it in backyards. And we're like, we're being distributed in people's backyards in 78704. That's our distribution. So just that whole, this whole mindset of what we have here, because I can genuinely say, as a person who makes a full-blown living making movies and has been offered $50 million+ movies, all it really is about is expressing the things that are inside of you and sharing them with other people. That's really all that matters.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Clayburgh Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. Generous support is also provided by the City of Austin Cultural Arts Division, the Texas Commission of the Arts, and the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services and the Texas Library and Archives Commission. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Our executive producer is Barbara Morgan, and the show is produced and edited by myself, Brian Ramos. For more On Story and Austin Film Festival, go to onstory.tv or austinfilmfestival.com.